Greetings. Welcome to another wonderful show. We've got John Kelly on today, and he's an international clinician and world-famous speech analyst who released key intelligence pertaining to the Iraq War 2 years in advance of the shock and awe strikes against Baghdad in 2003. And as a former feature producer for CBS Radio with experience in number one rated U.S. television, his work exploring consciousness, communications, the paranormal, and UFO phenomena have been featured in Huffington Post, USA Today, the Dallas Morning News, Florida Today, Wall Street Journal, Irish Independent, UC Irvine Today. I mean, I can go on and on. I want to bring him on the show. John, are you with us?
I sure am, James. It's great to speak with you again.
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Today, I wanted to cover the work you're doing, the clinical work and the reverse speech, and maybe give a little bit about the origin of that, how that works, and basically how that would help people in their own awakening and healing process.
I became prominent in media internationally as a speech analyst, as someone who had studied the reverse speech of David Oates in person and had really identified some of the key skill sets required to function and perform that role and procedure. I demonstrated exceptional strengths in this area early on, and that led to me being propelled up the chain of casework into national security prosecutions and other things in the late 1990s that involved police on three continents, intelligence and military agencies, all interested in the results of these cutting-edge studies that required or relied upon the reflections of the speech signal to detect unconscious communications. Interpreting unconscious communications, and the premise is that these particular set of communications are encrypted backwards in human speech. Now, elementary science, even going back over 100 to 150 years ago, the textbooks explained to us that the laws of reflection pertaining to light phenomena also pertain to sound phenomena. Sound and light phenomena are both subject to the laws of reflection. So the phenomenon of reflection is ancient. It's archaic. It's almost as old as the planet itself in terms of life here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And we're utilizing this ancient phenomenon of reflection to access some of the deepest parts of human consciousness. And so this sense of archetype is invoked. We talk about the mirror. We're talking about an ancient principle. And that has awakening powers within the minds of the speaker, the minds of the listener. A therapy based on reflection, in other words, has profound implications. Now, if we wind the clock up way up to the late 17th century, and Isaac Newton, the famous British mathematician and the founder of modern astronomy, developed what's called a reflector telescope. And he used mirrors of that time that were ground from polished metals that had a 34% light absorbency. So with handmade mirrors of the day, they were able to produce reflective surfaces that, although they reflected a significant amount of light, they actually absorbed 34% of it. And that number 34% is interesting and significant number, James. If you and I, in our conversation, for example, if 34% of our sentences were cut off every time we spoke, we might have a hard time understanding what each other was saying. Mm-hmm. 34% of the data loss, in other words, is significant. And yet Newton, working with such relatively rudimental mirrors, was still able to detect meaningful scientific phenomena. And it's noted that his reflector telescope was picking up on things like the phases of Venus, which, just like our moon, is subject to waxing and waning in mm-hmm. the sky. Yeah. And so, you know, it's crescent and full phases of Venus. He saw that through his telescope. He also saw the moons of Jupiter through his telescope. And these are known scientific phenomena. In other words, Newton's successors in the scientific arena over the centuries were able to replicate his observations using better and better equipment. So even with such primitive equipment that absorbed 34% of the data, 34% data loss, as if 34% of my statements were being cut off, Isaac Newton was still able to resolve important and substantial scientific phenomena. And so when we translate that into the 21st century, and people are using mirrors, digital mirrors, for audio reflection, we understand that those digital mirrors operate at 100% efficiency. They are lossless. There is zero signal loss in those reflections. And when we reflect the speech signal, the signal corruption or data corruption is really non-existent. We see what's there, and we see it with greater resolution than Isaac Newton, who was so successful and who was proven accurate generation after generation. But we're studying speech now in the sense that speech is a multidimensional stimulus. This is a concept that's been advanced by scientists, particularly those working at the University of California in Irvine, in papers that were published at the turn of the century and were noted in prestigious scientific journals, peer-reviewed journals, including Nature and the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. The Royal Society, England's premier scientific panel, was actually headed by Isaac Newton in his day. He was the president of the Royal Society in his time. So a study that discussed the resolution of speech signals that were mirrored forwards and backwards was discussed in the Philosophical Transactions of that Royal Society, which I find quite compelling considering that Newton's innovation with mirrors in his day led in part to his becoming the president of the society. The Royal Society still recognizes studies of reflection even in this time as significant. They've not abandoned Newton's interest in the mirror. Now, of course, people familiar with mythology and folklore will also understand the role of the mirror in pagan, indigenous, and other belief systems and spiritual practices. In Western folklore, people are familiar with the mirror of the Sleeping Beauty story, in which we have mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the greatest UFO videographer of them all.
Yeah, there you go.
We're familiar with the concept of the magic mirror. The notion of the mirror and its magical properties is found in Western folklore. It's found in Greek mysticism, classical Greek mysticism, and the mysticism of peoples throughout the world. The notion of reflection has profound archetypal and awakening powers. And so not only in the hard empirical material sciences, but also in folklore belief, superstition, mythology, indigenous religious and spiritual practices, the mirror has a place there as well. Newton and the scientists of his day were also mystics and alchemists. And so we understand that in the formative years of modern science, the personalities who were the leading thinkers of their time were not only inclined towards Cartesian materialism and atheism, they were mystics who sought self-integration, higher powers of awakening, consciousness, insight, that they felt that through their scientific practices that they would become better people. The perfection of the individual was also one of the goals of the early sciences. When we think about some of the ethical shortfalls of modern day science, nuclear explosions and radioactive pollution, we wonder if some of those inner directed ethics have been lost. And for good reason. But back in the day when the early scientific pioneers that are recognized as the forefathers, the founders of modern science, those folks were all deeply interested in mystical phenomena, as interdirected phenomena, as much as they were with observable phenomena, the physical world. So the mirror, again, has an interesting appeal. It appeals to the mystic, and it appears to the physicist, the hard physical scientist.
You used that here. I remember, I can totally vouch for it because I know when I think you and David John Oates, when I did an interview with Art Bell on Coast to Coast, you reverse speeched a lot of that. And it blew me away because when I was talking, when you reverse speeched, it brought a lot more information out that I was alluding to, but it was more detailed and more accurate. And the funniest one I thought was when Art was asking what the little blue lights were, around the Mary statue when that pink energy was coming down. And I said, I believe they're nature spirits, some kind of nature spirit. And then when you did reverse speech, I said, Mary's elves say to love her, And that one blew my mind. It tied in the nature kingdom with the masters and everything else. And the big gold ship, when it came in, I said, I don't know who's on those huge gold ships, but they feel like god beings, like ancient god beings or whatever. And then that reverse said Sailor Vishnu is his name.
Yeah, so this enriching characteristic that we can gather more insight through simple act of reflection has sort of a poetic meaning or significance. We're saying more than we may understand, and we're revealing more about ourselves and about facets of our personalities and our minds than we may know of. And through this engaging with these reflections, tremendous insight can be born, clarity, understanding, resolution, and integration can happen as a consequence of these engagements. And so I find that speech is so common and so easy for most folks who are born gifted with speech and hearing, that here is this untapped resource, seemingly, rich in insight and potential for all kinds of different applications. I was very inspired when I learned about these works, and I studied them in a post-secondary vocational in San Diego County. I was very close to the most well-known pioneer in this field in that time, and I paid my dues to make sure that I had something I may have had some aptitude for. I made sure that I accessed the best resources that were available at that time, including pursuing education in this field. You know, before I got involved in these studies, I had a longstanding practice in yoga meditation. It's something I pursued very vigorously and seriously. And yoga meditation is founded in Sanskrit culture. And even the notion of the Sanskrit alphabet with its 50 characters is understood to have originated from the inner sounds that were heard by people in deep in spiritual practices. They heard different sounds of the Sanskrit alphabet through their meditations associated with different emotions and different places in consciousness associated with the chakras. They're called the vrittis. So these 50 characters of the Sanskrit alphabet, which was a living language at one time, which is the language of Tantra Yoga, the word chakra itself is Sanskrit, that understood to be inner sound. Its origins were based on inner sound, and that engaging in communications in that language was stimulating the mind in deep ways. The extension of that understanding relates to a notion called mantra, which is sound, again, which has awakening powers, awakening of consciousness and energies within the body. And so these mantras of intensive yoga meditation practice are the vehicles for the mind to ascend past normal human consciousness states into profound states of cosmic awareness and integration, which is in the yogic model is understood to be like the goal of human existence, and all existence in the universe in that vein is meant to reintegrate with its point of origin. And again, the vehicle is sound, and humanly expressible or vocalized sound in the form of mantra. So I was deeply schooled and practiced in these areas. I mean, in the different talks that I've given at the ranch and the communications I've shared with folks on different topics on the times that we spent together, sometimes people feel that I may have spent a lot of my time reading books like the Vedas or, you know, I've certainly read Ramayana, I've read Mahabharata and the Gita, I've studied those works, but my understanding was from practical applications and practices. I meditated intensively for more than 20 years, and it was because I excelled in the practices that my clarity and understanding emerged, that I became more adept at interpreting the scriptures as a result of exercising the mind in those ways. So I can be a very bookish individual. I certainly haven't read the Vedas from beginning to end, but I gained profound insight into the concepts of those archaic texts because I lived the practices. I lived the experiences in Tantra Yoga. Conceptually, the beginner learns 95% through experience and 5% through theory. And then when the experiences are gained, then the theoretical material becomes the framework for understanding. When a person has tasted the sweet fruits of the Hood River Valley, you know, the orchards and the fruits that grow in the region, they're better enabled to understand conceptually what's going on, rather than if they just read about it in the book, you know, the Trout Lake herbs on the farms there. They just read about it on a paper or something like that. It's a long ways away from tasting and feeling the fineness of those their properties and engaging them experientially. And so that was really the probably the most important aspect of my education as a young person, is that I took formal training in yoga meditation and I practiced intensively. And as a result, I gained profound insight, which is the promise of those practices. My consciousness expanded, and I was able to apply those understandings. So when I saw these speech studies, I saw applied concepts of mantra for lay people, folks who weren't going to get on a serious, disciplined, rigorous meditation path with all the self-sacrifice and vegetarian diets that would have to go with that. I saw that for the average North American person, they could benefit from some of the spiritual science that was understood by our ancient people in classical cultures. They could benefit from it through these mirror reflections of speech. It was something that I recognized and I pursued.
There's a couple things that I noticed that you've been recently labeled as a conspiracy theorist or whatever. Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, I'm interested in like you, I'm interested in emerging areas of science and human knowledge and performance. And as a consequence, I have I've sacrificed the dignity of institutional recognition on a lot of fronts. And so a person like myself who persists in objective instrumental studies in areas like these speech studies or UFO studies, I'm up against the cultural wall of denial, the politicized wall of denial that is one of the burdens under which our culture operates. The CIA's Operation Mockingbird reportedly weaponized the term conspiracy theorist in the early 1960s as a rebuttal to those who studied the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, mm-hmm. and who challenged or even questioned the official testimonies as to the nature of those events. So we see the term conspiracy theorist is still rolled out today as part of discrediting campaigns against individuals who may be perceived as fomenting new thought. And if we translated that into our predecessors, our scientific predecessors like Galileo or Isaac Newton, you know, the same methodology would say that, you know, your telescopic observations, we're not even going to allow those. We're not going to even say those are admissible as evidence.
Yeah,
that's not even admissible. We're going to deny that the evidence exists, first of all. And now we're going to say that there's something wrong with you psychologically. And that's the only reason why you claim to perceive these things. And we know that, of course, the necessity of the Hubble Space Telescope and all these important scientific instruments that were developed later wouldn't have happened without someone like Newton. And so if we want to suppress the advancements of human knowledge, personal attacks, ad hominem attacks on individuals are one of the methodologies. And this is what we find on the national stage. Now, I'm still given time at the microphone. It's not like I've been, you know, sequestered away and not allowed anywhere on any media anywhere. It's not like that.
Yeah.
But the cost of free speech in this society and is not only criticism, but we're subject to ad hominem attack. And so the Huffington Post wrote a piece, and I worked closely with the writer over a number of years, and I thought he had written much better pieces in the past regarding my work in terms of offering fair and balanced perspective. But this piece was particularly slanted, in my opinion. And, intelligent readers who I shared the article with said, well, most of it didn't engage any of their thought processes to think further on the lines of debunking that were introduced. But I would like to say this, in terms of the present media era, like this month or this last 6 weeks or so, mm-hmm. these are interesting measurements that we can take on the pulse of the media and the pulse of the editorial direction in mainstream media, because there were actually been several articles published related to conspiracy theory. One was in a very prominent magazine called Newsweek, which most mainstream readers are familiar with, in which they cited conspiracy theories as a clear and present danger. So this very highly politicized rhetoric surrounding the concept of conspiracy theory. It's like a sort of a witch hunt type of media environment.
Yeah.
This very politicized speech. Now, conspiracy, in all practical terms, simply means, collusion between more than one party to achieve some kind of an event. And in all practical sense, conspiracies are happening all the time. People conspire to achieve different outcomes in all facets of life without you know, that term, in other words, exists without any kind of prejudice. It's just part, it's part of human existence. I think the most important rebuttal to what's been written recently about conspiracies and the danger of conspiracy in Newsweek and Vanity Fair has come from science. Some psychologists in Switzerland conducted a study in which they determined that people who could intelligently formulate a conspiracy theory as a means of describing events, those people actually were just demonstrating that they were mature, adult, intellectually developed individuals. Mm-hmm. It was a sign of their individuality that they thought they could formulate thought differently from what was necessarily being presented to them as suggestions or theories or official theories about anything. You know, in science, absent of any politics, theory is just a way of explaining or describing the universe. Science is, in that sense, meant to describe things. Mm-hmm. Theory is only a way of explaining or describing things, and a conspiracy theory is no different. Mm-hmm. You know, what mm-hmm. Newsweek and Vanity Fair were really getting on about comes down to challenging what in the United States have been constitutionally enshrined rights of free speech and freedom of assembly. People who want to freely communicate new insights and new potential ways of looking at the world that may be different from official interpretations, and people who want assemble freely around those ideas and congregate and share and discuss and like online forums or Facebook groups and things like that. This is where Newsweek is saying that this is dangerous behavior. This is what they're reporting. It's dangerous to exercise your free speech. It's dangerous to think as an individual, even if you lose a few friends temporarily over, you know, thinking differently. Sometimes, you know, we have differences of opinion. We don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. That happens. But this is understood, you know, in the psychological world, it's understood as part of being an adult. Sometimes we have to stand alone. And that's part of being individual.
Well, that study that you were citing, there was another study, and I don't know if it's the same one, but they showed that the people that did believe in conspiracy theories or actually challenged the status quo almost in every case had a much higher IQ than most others that go along with the status quo.
So this is basically, you know, to paint this in a very broad strokes, it's like the witch hunting of the intellectuals is something that we're facing in our culture today. Mm-hmm. There's an anti-intellectual sentiment, and this is not unlike the book burning cultures of the 20th century mm-hmm. that are much feared and wars were fought over. We're facing the same kind of anti-intellectual sentiment, and this is it is very dangerous. Because when this is done on the national stage, it inspires a mob response.
Yeah,
it's willfully dangerous rhetoric. I won't say it's hate speech, but I will say that the marginalization of the intellectuals is something that we face. And so those who would assume, who would be willing to stand on their own to give voice to a new opinion, a new insight, and to take mm-hmm. a chance, take a risk on their, you know, the rigor of their own intellect. Those people are subject to different kinds of dangers in culture. There are opponents to that kind of behavior. Compliance is being pushed on people on every level. People who work in large corporations are expected to think like their supervisors. You know, there's not a lot of wiggle room in corporate-oriented culture, nor do we find that in official military culture or political culture. Conformity mm-hmm. is being expressed, except that the unfortunate danger that we find is that the standards in leadership are slipping dramatically, particularly the ethical standards. Our colleague Alfred Lambert-Mont Weber recently cited how under normal, by-the-book legal conditions, the treason of the 9/11 situation in the United States would have been identified and the criminals would have been prosecuted. It may have even resulted in capital punishment for those individuals. Mm-hmm. And yet all of that has been allowed to slide. And so if we're expected to conform to that standard, then there's danger on a national scale. And this is the problem. This is why brave individuals who care about a future for grandchildren and the average people have to have to step up to the plate and give chance for new thought, new insight, give opportunity for that. I remember when I was reporting on the Iraq War 2 years before it began, one radio interview I did on a local radio station somewhere in the Idaho or Montana.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they had a caller call in. It was probably a whole thing probably staged. Mm-hmm. Dude was barking over the phone like a drill sergeant. And after I talked about President Bush's interest in going to war with Iraq, and maybe we should question that, he was barking away about, this isn't the time to question our president. This is the time to, toe up to the line and get ready to go to war. Just like a drill sergeant kind of, invocation to the masses, right? Mob hysteria, war hysteria, right? And so this is, we're gonna find that there are entrenched forces in society that want things to continue the way they are, except anyone with a little bit of gifted insight, those people have some extra duties and responsibility to make sure we do our best anyways. To help steer society in the best direction we can with the insight that we have. I think if all of us have been reincarnating like for millions of years just to get here today, then that the weight of that destiny it overrides any sort of temporary shortcoming, sacrifice, or difficulty. We have to answer ultimately. The soul has been journeying a long time and long ways just to get here today. We should answer to life's challenges in such a way that honors the difficult struggles that we endured just to get this far.
We should learn from the past, definitely. One thing I wanted to mention that you were talking about that is that in Nazi Germany, when they had their little fiasco there, and I don't know how many Jews they killed, I know some elderly people that were talking about that, and it says it wasn't just the Jews, it was the intellectuals, and anybody that challenged the status quo ended up in those camps.
Well, that we're talking the National Socialist society in Germany of the 1930s and 40s was an intensely propagandistic society as well. In other words, the weapon of propaganda was harnessed intensively. And there were very interesting studies. A Yale psychology professor wrote his insights into Goebbels' principles of propaganda in the 1950s, which is a very interesting article that could be found online. And if we examine the rhetoric of today, in terms of the mainstream newscasters, even just online Facebook group administrators, drawing very hard political lines in public discourse on issues like UFOs or other political questions, then we find reflections of Goebbels' practices. There are many famous quotes or memes that originated from those times about telling a lie often enough, it becomes the truth in the minds of the masses, attacking the character of individuals by labeling them and creating, characterizations of personalities rather than dealing with people as real people. All of these things were practiced at that time. Propaganda as a weapon is a very economic and efficient means for population control in the absence of having a gun pointed at everybody's head. It's cheaper to scare people than it is psychologically. It's cheaper to perpetuate a culture of fear than it is to actually implement a soldier on every street corner armed with heavy weapons who's ready to shoot and kill. So the German society under the National Socialists was heavily propagandized, and in fact, the principles that were developed through their research and practice were translated into modern advertising in North America. And, for the folks who are not as well read on these questions, there are strong links, historic links between the National Socialists of Germany and the major corporations of the United States. The Ford Motor Factory was where the German tank engines were being built in Germany. The Prescott Bush, the great grandfather of the contemporary Bushes, was engaged in doing business with the enemy well into the 1940s, and prosecution of his case was stayed through corruption. He was involved in the financing of Nazi Germany while the war, during World War II. So these well-known links in the underground community between those two societies, and of course, Operation Paperclip, which was the conspiracy. Or did I just use that word? The conspiracy to import the scientists who had worked in Nazi Germany, including the well-known Apollo rocket scientist von Braun. Without von Braun, the United States Apollo program wouldn't have been. He and other very prominent German expatriates who were brought into the United States under Operation Paperclip, who were also politically, they were Nazis, even SS. But this was overlooked for the war of profiteering, the pillaging of Germany's intellectual elite and technological advances, which were many of which were made under slave labor conditions, just like prison labor that exists in the United States today. A lot of the technological advantages in rocketry and other sciences was made under slave labor conditions. So terrible, immoral practices, unethical foundations. But those technological advances were brought to the United States, and they helped to bring the United States to a technical advantage over neighboring countries, and became the foundation. People say today that technology in black budget programs is 50 years or more ahead of anything we can imagine in the public sector. And there's a huge gap. People talk about a breakaway civilization. People talk about explorers living on Mars and going to the stars and stuff like that under these programs. So huge technological advantages that are enjoyed in material sciences that are also sequestered from the public, secret programs. I in the face of all of that, this political history, the darkness of it all, et cetera. It comes back to what we can do as individuals living in the mainstream. We're not rocket scientists. We don't have privy access to secret space programs. What can we do? It's individual development, spiritual consciousness development, overcoming the inhibitors to growth, working with empowering resources and tools.
Some of the reverse speeches that you've done, I know it's excellent for therapy purpose and things of that nature, but I know you've done some reverse speech on several. I'm not sure who you have geared up there, but I remember in the past you had a lot of them on Bush where he would say, "I'll finish it, Daddy," and things like that, talking about the Iraq War. I think one of the amazing things about reverse speech is that it really takes the mask off the politicians and the people that have been lying to humanity for God knows for how long, and we can actually find out what they're really up to, what they're really planning.
Well, people who love truth love this kind of phenomena because the messages that we can detect are involuntary in nature, just as involuntary as people when they sleep talk. James, I'm sure you know people who talk in their sleep.
Yeah.
So that sleep talking is unconscious communications. So we know that this happens. We know that the unconscious assumes control of the muscular organs that form speech, the lips, the larynx, the tongue, etc., can be controlled through unconscious impulses. And so sleep talking demonstrates that. This just takes us a step further and says it's like encrypted sleep talking, encrypted unconscious speech. And people who love truth, who are tired of the politics of denial, the culture of cover-up that colors modern discourse in the political spheres and social spheres, see this as a cutting-edge technology to break through the truth embargo surrounding issues like UFO phenomena, such as ET contacts, spiritual phenomena, things that are evidently within the easy reach of the average person who will only just try, just make a little effort in that direction. If only people understood that a few steps on their part to get them so much closer to things that we're being told every day that are impossible in this culture of denial. One of the areas, pre-verbal children is typically an area that people want to look at to understand these phenomena in context of children who can vocalize but who may not be able to give formal speech communications or maybe too young. Mm-hmm. And so I've sampled some different audio from here. This young boy is talking to his father on a cell phone. The dad is explaining that he's got work that's keeping him at the office and he won't be able to do something with his son that day. So he's just talking to his son over the phone and you can hear the child respond. Okay, James, we can hear the baby's just vocalizing.
Yeah.
Engaging with his father.
Uh-huh.
But not in a way that's really mature speech. However, when I flip that around, when I mirror that audio using my audio editor, my digital audio editor, that perfect mirror reflection, mm-hmm. I can hear the words, "I'm very angry, Daddy." So while these preverbal children are vocalizing, they're actually able to formulate expressions that are meaningful to adult listeners, not just goo goo gaga, but meaningful statements rich with information. Here's the forward speech, which is just like baby babble, but backwards. So let's leap now to our mature adult speakers and their daddies and the issues surrounding this relationship.
Okay.
As requested, one of the famous investigations in which I use this methodology involved the inaugural speech of President George W. Bush in January of 2001, mm-hmm. and the changing of the guard in the White House from the Clinton era of the 1990s to the new Bush administration, under which so many dramatic changes happened in United States society and around the world. President Bush, during his inaugural, said these remarks.
"And to all nations, we will speak for the values that gave our nation birth."
We're talking about historic values, mm-hmm. historic American values, but backwards the words say, "Mission of Baghdad." Again, if we want to listen to the source audio, mm-hmm. just digital editor, I can flip that around.
"That gave our nation."
The mirror reflection states, I thought that was quite compelling. A little mm-hmm. bit of intelligence information there, military grade intelligence.
Yeah.
And it was compounded. You know, it wasn't the only thing that I heard. There was thematic development in my transcript that allowed me to understand the key issues that were being communicated, including the speaker who followed the president during that ceremony, which was the pastor, Kirby Caldwell, who gave a benediction.
"Deliver us from these and all other evils, and cast our sins into your sea of forgetfulness."
And the mirror reflection, I heard him say, "Missile attack."
"Missile attack. Missile attack. Missile attack."
And again, if we wanted to reflect on the source audio, it's right here.
"Cast our sin."
In reverse.
Mm-hmm. "Missile attack."
A mission of Baghdad and a missile attack could only describe one thing. Viewed in 2020 hindsight, we can understand how it was that through this unconscious form of communication, these encrypted messages, speakers during the January 2001 inaugural address were discussing the shock and awe missile strikes on Baghdad that inaugurated the Iraq War in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds pretty easy to pick that up.
Now, it's quite a compelling demonstration because this reveals how, as a forecasting methodology, detection of these signals informs us about future global events, which is a subject of great interest to people involved in economics and other types of long-term planning. Mm-hmm. And so the nature of time itself is highlighted through the existence of these phenomena and our ability to measure that they exist and that they communicate meaningful information. Here we have a future event described in livid military precision detail with a geographic place name, Baghdad, and a strike technology, a missile strike. That's lividly precise. What does this tell us about the nature of time? The messages are transmitting against what physicists call the arrow of time. In the current model of how time works, everything's moving in one direction, that is forwards towards our future. Mm-hmm. And this arrow of time, the conceptual arrow, points in that direction. But here, the message transmission is evidently opposite of that, or reflection against that arrow of time. Transmission is taking place against the flow of time itself, evidently. And therefore, we can determine how it is that the consciousness engaged in the formulation and distribution of these messages is, in fact, time independent. That it's functioning independent of the forwards flow of time described through what physicists call the arrow of time. And this time independence, I think, is a very interesting concept. because it's found in the spiritual literature from classical cultures. People talk about the eternal now. Mm-hmm. In spiritual philosophy, the present time, and that in higher consciousness, that everything, past, present, and future, is a continuum of nowness. It's just it's unified into one state of time that's perpetual, or infinity, so to speak. Mm-hmm. an infinite now. And so we are really invoking that higher consciousness in its capacity to formulate and transmit against physical arrow of time, or physical flow of time, which is what we experience every day. I think it's very important when we're looking at this type of forecasting to understand that. And this wasn't the only instance in which I was able to produce a meaningful forecast. That particular sample demonstrates military level precision. But we're going to look now at forensic studies of a perpetual social dilemma that we find ourselves in contemporary culture, which have to do with these mass killings, mm-hmm. serial killings, very unfortunate part of our society, certainly an area that needs to be reconciled within communities. One study that I conducted at the early part of the century was related to the BTK killer in Wichita, Kansas, BTK meaning bind, torture, and kill, a terrible sadistic home invader who used to tie people up and murder them in their homes. Dennis Rader was a civic official in Wichita, Kansas, who was arrested on suspicion of his involvement in these crimes. And he gave a jailhouse interview awaiting a hearing in front of a judge on local television. And I collected that audio as it was public domain, it was broadcast television, and I produced a study which was compelling in many different ways. Now, when I went into the study, there were many things I didn't know about the crimes. And one facet that emerged later on in my investigation was that the known killer had sent letters to the local police and television journalists in the 1970s when he was active. Mm-hmm. And he was taunting them, stating that he knew specific details of the crime scenes that only someone who had been present would know. In other words, the police had not published these details anywhere. They had held them back due to the capacity for people to emerge from the public and lay claim to the crimes who had not been involved at all. Just, mm-hmm. People who were hoaxing.
Yeah.
In this case, they identified that there were facets of the letters that described key details that only someone present at the scene could know. And they said this authenticated the letters. Well, there was something specific in those letters that was really striking. And this is how it helped me to understand how it was. There was a parallelism, in other words, between Dennis Rader's secret messages and the letters of the BTK killer. Let's listen to Dennis Rader talk forwards about preparing for his hearing.
So now that party, the guy's going to be subpoenaed in, or has been subpoenaed in, we cannot talk to that party. They can't come here for visits.
It just sounds like he's preparing for paperwork, you know, going mm-hmm. to court, a little bit of administrative duty. Doesn't sound like anything too exciting going on there. Mm-hmm. Play backwards, quite a different message. In the mirror, I heard the reflection that stated, the demons influenced that guy. Now, mm-hmm. I presented this material on morning radio in Wichita, Kansas, 15 minutes before Dennis Rader's hearing. On the day of the hearing, I was on morning radio in Wichita, mm-hmm. Kansas, with my story, with this report, with a series of clips, including this one, and with my understanding of those letters that BTK had written, authenticated by the police, in which he stated, I feel like I'm possessed by a demon. Mm-hmm. And so the authenticated letters talked about demonic possession. Dennis Rader's secret messages talked about demonic possession. It was very compelling for me to understand how there was a parallelism between the two, and how seemingly unusual it was for Dennis Rader to have demonic possession-related messages, demonic influence messages, particularly when BTK was talking about that. Mm-hmm. Well, Dennis Rader went before the judge for a hearing, a pretrial hearing, and he confessed at length to all of the BTK killer crimes that very morning after I had just been on the air in that city. Quite, you know, what parallelism to be involved at that level and, you know, mm-hmm. in a local community issue, producing forensic evidence of this sort. 2 weeks after his confession, when he was on the way out of town to serve a term in prison for the killings, Dennis Rader went further and stated aloud that he felt that he was possessed by a demon. And so the speaker, in this case, validated my findings remotely from thousands of miles away. He validated them. No one was talking about Dennis Rader's demons before his confession. I was the lone voice.
Yeah.
We were talking before about, you know, being a mature adult sometimes means willing to accept a little bit of isolation when you take a stand.
Yeah.
So I took a stand on what I believe to be factual based on instrumental evidence, which are these recordings and my resolution of them. And in fact, it turned out to be dramatically true in a very unexpected way. The letters have been vetted. The parallelisms between Rader's messages and the letters were striking. I reported it in Wichita, and Dennis Rader himself, 2 weeks later, said aloud, "I feel like I'm possessed by a demon." Case closed. These phenomena exist. It would be impossible, but there is no simpler means, in other words, by Occam's razor, which says that the simplest explanation is the most truthful.
Yeah.
There is no simpler explanation for how I accomplished this. There is no simpler explanation than that these phenomena are real, that they are scientifically valid, and that they are worthy of further study, and that the information that is resolved from within them is scientifically valid as Newton's perceptions of the phases of Venus and the moons of Jupiter, which were also resolved using a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I'm simply reflecting sound, whereas Newton reflected light.
Yeah.
But as elementary physics explained to us, even in textbooks that are over 100 years old, the elementary science understands that the laws of reflection apply equally to light phenomena and sound phenomena. It's the same thing. Mirror reflection is mirror reflection, whether you reflect light, whether you reflect sound. The angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Do you have anything on our illustrious leader over here?
Well, he has a lot to say about the undercurrents of ET contact that color political statements and military leadership statements throughout contemporary history in the United States. You know, it's the elephant in the room that no one talks about except in unconscious ways.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama's inaugural address, of course, a great opportunity now at the turn of the era from the Bush administration into the new Obama administration of 2009. I studied that inaugural address to find these remarks.
Even greater cooperation and understanding between nations. We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan.
In which I heard the words, knows power of alien saucers. You know, people say that the presidents are... presidents are debriefed on UFO technology and contact issues prior to assuming office, or as a condition of assuming office, to a certain extent, they're given privileged access. And so it occurred to me that the president had maybe received such briefing or had some insight into those questions. But to amplify this further, the president, Secretary of State John Kerry, in his remarks concerning the Ukraine, also had something to say about this topic. Let's listen to that comment from Secretary of State Kerry.
We believe it is not insignificant that we acknowledge there are legitimate interests, historical, cultural, current, strategic. These are real interests. And I think all of us who are joined together in the EU and extended contact group understand those interests and are prepared to respect them. But that requires also that Russia would respect the multilateral structure that has guided our actions since World War II.
Those are his comments in London, England, from March of this year. And there were two messages within those statements. The first stated the capture was gray. Talking about capturing something that has to do with gray, but the second message says they shot down the saucer. Gray alien saucers in the secretary's comments is, you know, it's this ET contact cover up in the United States is the elephant in the diplomatic political room. Everyone seems to have something to say about it. And I mean everybody. Former New Hampshire state legislator Henry McElroy gave an informal on camera statement at the time of his retirement a few years ago. Caused quite a stir, talking about President Eisenhower receiving an invitation, a formal invitation to communicate with extraterrestrials. There was an actual memo that McElroy had seen, an official document. He cited that here.
And it informed President Eisenhower of the continued presence of extraterrestrial beings here in the United States of America.
Played in reverse, I could vet Henry McElroy's statements further by determining that he said also, the alien, the grays.
The alien, the gray. The alien, the gray.
I really think they're all talking about the same thing. I think they're all talking about government involvement with UFOs and extraterrestrials. President Obama, Secretary of State Kerry, former New Hampshire state legislator Henry McElroy, Betty Hill, one of the famous first abduction cases that emerged in public notice in the 1960s, The Interrupted Journey.
Mm-hmm.
There was a book and a movie. She spoke extensively right into her senior years in public. She engaged the public to tell her story and to clarify comments and answer questions to people who are interested to know further about what happened to her and her husband. Here she's talking about driving down the highway from a visit to Canada, returning to New York State.
Yes, a buddy did in World War II. He knew planes, and he's trying to identify this. And it's flying in a very erratic manner, which was very puzzling to us. But this is 61. We'd heard UFO. Well, actually, in those days, they called them flying saucers. We had no idea what a flying saucer looked like, but we had no fear, just curiosity. We were trying to identify this craft.
So a very interesting, very psychological message emerges from Betty Hill's testimony. You know, people like to question whether these abductees are really, you know, are they making all this up? It's just the only evidence they have is maybe hypnosis. Is it how factual are these remarks about abduction after all? So here's a great opportunity to vet those statements. Let's listen to it through the mirror. What does she say? I hear the words, the saucer, I'll block it.
The saucer, I'll block it. The saucer, I'll block it.
She talks about blocking memories of a saucer as if it was something she didn't want to remember. And if anyone had listened to the Leo Sprinkle hypnosis tapes that were done with Barney Hill, mm-hmm. and how terrorized he apparently was by what happened, well, I don't think they would want to remember any of that. So it seems to make sense. It seems to match up. It seems to validate her claim that she was engaged with extraterrestrials, that they saw a UFO, a saucer. And that, in fact, she gave her testimony publicly and repeatedly to her own discomfort. This was not something she ever felt really good or resolved about. That recording's from the early 1990s, but the story broke in the 1960s. All those years that she was willing to speak to this issue, to give voice to, you know, for a population that was otherwise being silenced by the culture of denial, mm-hmm. the culture of ridicule, she did it at her own discomfort because fundamentally it seemed that she was never fully resolved with her feelings about what had happened, how difficult it had been for her and her husband. She didn't want to remember it. She says she'll block it. You know, if this was some kind of a fraud or a hoax for money or something like that, maybe the message would say, you know, the saucer, I'll tell you all about it.
Yeah.
Like, without any hesitation. But here, there's apparently inhibition. And mm-hmm. this is something that would be very difficult, in my opinion, to fabricate. It would be very difficult to contrive an unconscious inhibition that would be like sleep talking about your inhibitions, an inhibition that was so deep that you would sleep talk about it. I think that would be very difficult to contrive. There's something to the Betty Hill story. There's something to those stories. I don't pretend to understand all of it, but this methodology applied to the testimony of the UFO contactees, the witnesses, the experiencers, is very useful. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, whose research extended as far as the Mount Adams and Yakima region in the Bisetti Ranch area from the 1970s, he supported the commencement of a program to study what's known as the Yakima Lights.
Yeah.
Dr. Hynek had something to say about Project Blue Book as part of a cover-up in that there were no innovations in the development of new techniques for witness interrogations or the extraction of testimonies. There were no techniques developed through Project Blue Book. And he found that very unscientific, and it contributed to his feelings that Blue Book was a complete cover-up. And so here we are in the 21st century answering to the legacy science inquiries of thinkers like astronomer Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the federal government's UFO scientist at the time of Project Blue Book. He was employed by the federal government to investigate UFOs. This person has some status and repute, and he said that there was a need, he suggested the need for better interrogative methods. Mm-hmm. And here we are in the 21st century applying a new methodology and extracting new testimony that has never been heard before. This is fresh, new testimony that has never been heard, never been published. And this is what this breakthrough communications procedure is allowing us to do. And we're mining the rich vein of the spoken word, which is widely available. Mm-hmm. And the method involves archaic technology, you know, the mirror and the principle or phenomena of reflection. I mean, that's on this planet, that's 4.3 billion years old. So it's pretty archaic. What we're doing really is looking at things in a new way. I mean, if this is some kind of conspiracy, the conspiracy is to rethink the relationship between sound, reflection, voice communications, to rethink those relationships in ways that can apply existing technologies to existing phenomena to produce novel results or effects or insights. That's the conspiracy. And I've been conspiring to work in this manner for 15-odd years with great success. Mm-hmm. I've shared with you today and your audience how it is that in the public domain, through widespread terrestrial broadcasts on mainstream talk radio platforms, many of which I have the archive, the show tapes from the station with their own letterhead on the mm-hmm. on the stamp and stuff like that, third-party documentation. I presented these materials before the facts were validated by real-world events. The power of this as a forecasting tool was demonstrated over and over again. And some people like to say that my work is entirely experimental, and I was just experimenting with these phenomena. But I would say I would up the ante further and say that actually I'm finished with the experimentation stage, and I'm into the demonstration stage. And you can't have a demonstration without a valid phenomena. You can't mm-hmm. demonstrate something that doesn't exist. I demonstrated this in ways that are kind of irrefutable. You can't take back the fact that I was reporting on Iraq war details with military precision 2 years before it started. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of public knowledge and public record that happened, and with Dennis Rader and with Edward Snowden and on and on and on. And my clients who work with me clinically know this about the profound significance of the information in terms of personal meaning for the speaker. They mm-hmm. they know about this in the private sessions. Well, we simply couldn't produce that kind of level of detail on a regular basis if we weren't working with a real phenomena. So, in other words, this conspiracy labeling that most recently was transmitted through the Huffington Post, it became the venue for the CIA censors to step up and the rhetoric. It's complete nonsense. It's flying in the face of evidence. Mm-hmm. And the evidence is instrumental, and it's a matter of public record, and there's third-party documentation. You know, to say that there's no moons of Jupiter and no phases of Venus is to condemn society to the Stone Age. Yeah. We deserve better than that. And the great opportunity in our time is for people to access easy and simple technologies like this and related, you know, reflective, inner-directed procedures to access these for personal growth and development, to engage consciousness in ways that makes us stronger, more visionary, more prophetic, more capable, higher performing. This is the direction we can go in, and this is available today. In spite of all the secrecy, all the denial, the black budgets, sequestering, surveillance, and all the other problems of our society, there is still a chance today for people to gain insight and profound growth and development. This procedure that I offer is one way to do it.
Well, I know you've got a lot of reverse speech on the docket here that we don't have time to cover today, but we're going to have you up here at the ranch for the conference coming up around the 26th. So, you know, that's going to be awesome to hear some of the latest maybe on Snowden or leadership or where, you know, get a good insight as to where we're going. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
I'm available online through my website, yourinnervoice.com. And I can also be reached toll-free North America-wide through my number 1-888-453-0751, 1-888-453-0751.
Great. And people can go to esetireservations@gmail.com if they want to check out the conference and get more information on that. You can go to eseti.org, you know, a regular website, and then from there go to esetireservations@gmail.com. And you can find out more about the conference and the wonderful speakers. We have myself, John Kelly, Barbara Lamb, Sonia Barrett. There's a whole host of other speakers as well. So, unfortunately, we're out of time, but John, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I look forward to seeing you here up at the ranch.
I look forward to seeing you and all of our friends at the ranch again. It's been wonderful speaking with you, James, and God bless, and see you soon.